So that you'll know the geography of the sermon. I'm reading for our scripture lesson, the 51st Psalm. When we touch down in the text, it's going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 11. If that's confusing to you now, after I'm through speaking, it will have been even more confusing. Psalm 51, and you'll notice that the superscription says that this was for the choir director, but it's a psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba. That superscription is as old as the psalm. As far back as we have been able to go in finding manuscripts, wherever you have the psalm, you have that superscription. It was not put in by the editors of the Scofield Bible. It evidently was put in by the compiler of the psalm so that we would know the background of the hymn. The 51st psalm. Be gracious to me, O God, according to thy loving kindness. According to the greatness of thy compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against thee only, I have sinned and done what is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified when thou dost speak and blameless when thou dost judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, thou dost desire truth in the innermost being, and in the hidden part thou wilt make me to know wisdom. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness. Let the bones which thou hast broken rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, and blot out my iniquity. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from thy presence, and do not take thy Holy Spirit from me. But restore to me the joy of thy salvation, and sustain me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors thy way, and sinners will be converted to thee. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God, thou God of my salvation. Then my tongue will joyfully sing of thy righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare thy praise. For thou dost not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. Thou art not pleased with burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God. Thou wilt not despise. By thy favor do good to Zion. Build the walls of Jerusalem. Then thou wilt delight in righteous sacrifices, in burnt offerings, and whole burnt offerings. Then young bulls will be offered on thine altar. May the Spirit of God who has breathed upon this page use its truth to breathe upon our lives today. We're going to be led in our morning prayer by Mr. James Dean, one of our elders. He comes to pray for us and for the needs of the people in this congregation. His name was David. He was a king living in the city of Jerusalem. And another day his name might have been Harry or Alan or Bruce or Kenneth. And another time he might have been an athlete or a general, a businessman, a poet, even a preacher. But his name was David, and he was a king living in the city of Jerusalem. When you say that David was a king, you mean that he was a 24-carat king. You do not mean that he was a Bedouin being followed by a band of bandits who simply seized that title for himself. Nor do you mean that he was a chief politician that had taken over a city and forced the people to call him the magistrate. But David was a king. The king of Judah, king of Israel, king of Ammon, king of the Moabites, king of the Perizzites, king of the Philistines. As far as the eye could see, as far as the foot could walk, David was a man in control. But as more, David had gotten to the top the hard way. Every step along the way had been a struggle and an agony. David had to fight against a very difficult family background. He was the last of 8 sons, one of 10 children. And so when David was born, his father was old, very old. You've heard about generation gaps, but between David and his father, there was something like the Grand Canyon, and often when they talked to each other, they had to yell across the gap. I think that Dr. John Hurkus was right when he said that David struggled against that family background all of his life, where David was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And imagine what it meant to take a boy with 150-ish IQ, with the hand-to-eye coordination of a Bobby Hull, with the poetic ability of a Shakespeare, the musical ability of a Van Cliburn, the military genius of a Napoleon, and put him down in the midst of a family where some of the brothers probably couldn't have gotten through high school, where their favorite instrument was a bass drum, who despised poetry and who looked down at David and thought he was queer because he was not like them. You put a boy in that kind of environment and he has to fight against it all of his life. But it's more, David had to fight against Saul. Early in his life, God had told David that he would become the king of Israel. And David was willing to wait until God gave him that office. He had too much respect for the throne, too much regard for God to seize the throne himself. But Saul was the king of Israel. And Saul was a man of dark and murky moods, and so he looked at David as an opponent. He turned David into public enemy, number one. For 10 years he pursued him as a dog chases a rabbit out into the wilderness, up into the mountains, forcing him to live like a criminal in a cave. David was an outlaw and an outcast. And for 10 years he was forced to live by his stealth and wit. If you talk to the historians, they would tell you that the greatest battles that David had to fight were against the Philistines. For the Philistines were the number one nation in Western Asia. Not only were the Philistines a military power, they were also an economic power. You see, the Philistines had discovered the secret of smelting iron. That whenever a Hebrew or anyone else wanted to buy an axe, he had to deal with the Philistines. Whenever they wanted to sharpen in a plow, they had to find the Philistine blacksmith. And so for almost 200 years, the Philistines were the nation in control. And David beat them. It took him 10 years to do it, but he beat them. He beat them man on man when he went up against their giant Goliath. He beat them in guerrilla warfare, and ultimately he beat them army against army. And he drove the Philistines into the sea. Once the Philistines fell, then all of the other nations fell like dominoes. And for 17 years, Israel enjoyed unbroken prosperity. For over a decade and a half, David had not lost a major battle. And now he was a king, sitting in his throne in Jerusalem. And the people admired him. They admired him in the same way that you might admire a man who went through college and medical school and internship and residency and had to support a family and fight a couple of demons along the way. And they not only admired him for what he had accomplished, they had admired him for what he was. You were going to give an evangelistic dinner for princes and kings. David is the man that you'd ask to speak. So they would come to hear him because he had made it to the top of their profession. But you would invite him because David was a man open on the Godward side. He was a man of faith, a man of integrity before God. And now he sits as a king in his throne in Jerusalem. The hearts of the people open to him like the flowers open to the kiss of the noontime sun. And he is secure. Doesn't have to worry about fighting anymore. All of that is behind him. In fact, once he did what he should not have done, he decided that he would count his troops and found that there were 1,300,000 men in Judah and Israel able to fight for him and die for him. He had generals to direct the troops and troops to fight. But it's more, there in the palace, he was through with all of the scut work of life. He was surrounded with people who gave their lives to make his life easier, like secretaries or nurses might be today. And in that position, David had become self-sufficient. He could sit back and take life easy. All of the dreams of his boyhood had been fulfilled. Now, David had made it to the top after a struggle. And in the vernacular of the marketplace, he had it made in the shade. Inwardly, however, I suspect that there were still some problems, some unresolved tensions in David's life. I suspect that he might have faced them as he stood before the great bronze mirrors in the palace, and was a little upset by what he saw. Because every time he looked, he saw decay winning the battle over youth. There was the receding hairline. There was the hair touched by the snow of years, and that was a mixed blessing. For after all, the gray hair looked rather good on the head of a king. But it was also the sign of approaching age. And there were the bags under his eyes and the lines in his face. And there was that point. That had not always been there. Certainly not when he was a boy out on his father's farm. Certainly not when he was a young soldier escaping from Saul's troops, leaping over walls in order to get away. But it was there now. All of the tailors in the palace could cover it up quite easily with his robes, but it was there. It bothered him. He was bothered, too, about his marriages. There were 7 of them. None of them had turned out very well. Some of them he could write off as being just political maneuvers. He could do that, for example, with his marriage to Michal, the daughter of Saul. He had married her because that jumped him into king space, and there wasn't really much more to it. Oh, at first it looked like they had something going for them because Michal saw David as the people's champion. After all, they had written hit songs about him. But after a while, that relationship began to tarnish, and Michal turned into a nagger and a shrew. It was Abigail. Well, that wasn't a political alliance. David remembered how he felt when he first met her. She combined brilliance and beauty, and that was a great combination. David remembered how his blood raced when he first met her. He remembered that he was like putty in her hand. As soon as her husband Nabal died, he took that beautiful and brilliant girl and made her his queen. That was 14 years ago. And Abigail now had just sort of settled down to being plain Abby. One thing was certain, he hadn't done very much for his blood rate lately. Yeah, that was the trouble with David in his 47th year as he reigned as king. Life had gotten flat for him. Even his relationship with God had gotten flat. Oh, there was a time back early in his life when God was so close to David he could almost reach up and touch him. There were times out there in the desert when he cried out to God for deliverance and he could feel the power of God working on his behalf. There were other times when he was confused and bewildered and he cried out to God for an explanation, but God was at least real to him so that he could call out for some answer to his question. There were times sitting by a campfire. David's heart was so filled with music that it just burst out in songs of praise. But there hadn't been too many songs lately either. That's what happens when you get to your middle life, 47th year. I'm a lot more practical. David wrote all of that off as the emotionalism of his youth, the idealism of his growing up years. But when you get to be 47, you're much more practical. Far better to plant potatoes than roses. Far better to have something to eat than something to smell. And that's the way it was with David in his 47th year. He was king, the pure, even self-sufficient, living in the city of Jerusalem. But down where he really lived, that's where all of us live. Down inside the palace of his own soul, life had gotten flat. And he was a big boy. And that's where we meet him when we come to 2 Samuel chapter 11. It's the spring of the year in Jerusalem, probably the first 2 weeks in April. According to the tourist agents, it's the best time to visit the city, but after we've gotten here, we're a bit disappointed that we've come. Because the rains have stopped and the flowers are growing, but this is the time of the year when kings go forth to war. Up to now, the ground was too muddy so that the troops would bog down in the mire. So kings had fighting to do. They waited till the ground got hard, and we realize that we've come at the wrong time because David is a general. He'll be out fighting with his troops. So we're a bit surprised to discover that this year David has decided to stay in Jerusalem. So we can understand that. Of course, he's a king now, and a king has to administer, and he's got treaties to negotiate and papers to sign and a nation to govern. Well, we'll catch a glimpse of him as we get to the throne room. We discover that David is not in the throne room. Instead, in the middle of the afternoon, we discover that David is on the roof of the palace in a small room designed to catch the afternoon breeze. David, the king of Israel, is asleep. That strikes us a bit strange. If David had been 30 years older, we could understand the afternoon nap. After all, he has to conserve his strength. If he had been sick and was recovering from some disease, we could understand his attempts to recuperate. But David isn't old and David isn't sick. He's napping in the afternoon. Evidently, he's gotten a bit too close because obviously he has awakened. We see him as he sits up and stretches and then walks along the roof of the palace and glances down at the gardens that surround his palace. And then beyond the gardens, he sees a house. And in the center of that house, he sees a courtyard. In the courtyard, he sees a woman bathing. She's beautiful. He sees that life from body and looks at it as a man might look at the centerfold of a man's magazine. David will not take his eyes off of her. And after she is through with her rites of purification, and she goes inside, David cannot get her out of his mind. And so he turns to one of the servants and says, "You know, just occurred to me. I've been here in this palace for 13 years, and I still don't know a lot of my neighbors. Look, who lives in that house over there? Or that one over there? Or that house there with the courtyard?" "Court. Uriah the Hittite. I should have known. He's one of my 30 mighty men. And his wife's name, Bathsheba. I've met her. She's been here at the palace. She's a very intelligent girl, isn't she? They know her father, Eliam, and her grandfather, one of my advisors. How could I have missed it? It's strange how you can live in a neighborhood and not know your neighbors. Well, it must be difficult to be a wife when your husband is off to war. I never thought about that before. Look, I wish you'd do something for me. This afternoon, when you're down that way, I wish you would ask Bathsheba to come to see me, because perhaps we could talk, and maybe I can be a bit of help." We don't know how David did it. We do not know if his approach was subtle or direct. But the ancient historian simply tells us in verse 3, "So David sent and inquired about the woman. And David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her." Bathsheba comes. And as I read this record, there are simply the cold, hard facts given by this ancient historian. And frankly, I'm curious enough to wish that there were some of the hot cross back. I can't help but wonder about Bathsheba. I wonder, with her bathing there out in the courtyard, was that seductive? Was she attempting to draw the eye of the king and create lust in his heart? The writer doesn't tell it. Perhaps because it really doesn't matter. Because if it hadn't been Bathsheba, there would have been others. They're always there, you know. The woman whose father did not pay enough attention to her in her growing up years, and in her later years seeks some kind of relationship with an older man. Or the secretary who has turned seduction into a fine art. Or the wife whose husband is away too much. Or the girl who is just flattered to have the attention of a man in front of her. They're always there, and if it had not been Bathsheba, there could have been someone else. Now, he just says that he came to him and he lay with him. Can't help but wonder, can you? You wonder if it was something soft and slow and beautiful, or whether it was something impulsive and brutish, something closer to rape or robbery than it was to love. But in the words of the Bible, they committed adultery. I know. I know I shouldn't have said that. That's a little harsh, a little judgmental to use a word like adultery for something like this. I'm sure David would not have said that. I'm sure David would have said it was a kind of a fling. It's just an affair, a casual thing in an afternoon, an act of love, maybe even a meaningful relationship. But adultery sounds so hard. He sent Bathsheba home and it was forgotten. So about 4 weeks later, David received a note and it was terse and to the point. It said, "I am pregnant." Signed D. That's as casual as David thought. It never is, really, is it? This relationship into which two people come, and out of that relationship there can come a human life that has a personality that is going to live someplace forever. It's never quite as casual as we might like to make it in our casual age. I can almost feel the ball of tension as it increased in David's stomach. I can almost see his hands shake as he realized the implications of what he read. Just a week or two, Bathsheba would begin to show, and everybody would know what had taken place while her husband was away at battle. And what is more, she would implicate him. And the book of Leviticus said that if a couple committed adultery, that couple would die. And the law of Israel applied to kings as well as commoners. I'm sure that after a few moments, David became the man in control again. He had been in difficulties before, and a thing like this would not throw him. And so he knew he had to bring Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, back home to Jerusalem and get the two of them in bed again, because he had to cover up what had taken place. And he sat down and wrote a note to Joab, his general, and said, "Send home Uriah." And then David had to think about the interview with Uriah. He was one of the 30 mighty men, one of the top generals on the field, and you do not ask a general to come back home to do the work of a messenger. So he had to say just the right thing. He had to ask the right question. He had to make the right comment. When Uriah came, David was ready for him. "Uriah, I really appreciate you coming. Can't imagine what it's like to be here at home and the battle is going off there in the field and you're not part of it. I needed a strategist across here. How's the battle going? What kind of strategy is Joab using? What's the morale of the troops? How long do you think it'll take us to capture the city?" Or also the right comment. "Can't imagine what it's like to be an administrator. Sometimes I wish I was just a common soldier again with all of these things to sign, all of this to do. You just can't imagine how difficult it is." And after he had said what he thought was appropriate, said, Uriah, I'm sure you're tired. And I know it's tough to be out there in the battlefield, and I'm sure you'll want to see Bathsheba again, so I'll not keep you any longer, but I appreciate your coming. You go on home. The scripture says in verse 8 of chapter 11, and Uriah went out of the king's house, and the present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord, and he didn't go down to his house. I wonder how David found that out. Maybe it was the next morning at breakfast. One of the servants was setting out his breakfast and said to him, it's been wonderful to have Uriah back, sir. Good to see him again. My, I tell you, he's a storyteller, that man. You know, he kept us up half the night telling the stories of battle. Kind of strange, you know. If it had been me, I'd like to have spent the night with the wife and seen the kids again, but he didn't even bother to go home. I'm sure that must have spoiled David's breakfast. A little later in the day, as soon as he could, he found Uriah. Uriah, said, you things have changed since I was a soldier. I would have thought you would have wanted to spend some time with Bathsheba. Hey, you're slipping right here in the palace. You certainly need some rest and relaxation. Uriah, he saw I couldn't do it. You see, my soldiers are out there in the battlefield fighting my battles. And they have to sleep out on the cold ground, and they have to eat rations, and they have to live under tents. And it just didn't seem right for me to come home and enjoy the love of my wife and even the food at home when my soldiers were out there fighting. I'm sure David didn't know who this was standing in front of him. He wasn't sure whether this man was noble or suspicious. You don't get to be one of the 30 mighty men by being a fool, and gossip sweeps through the corridors of a palace very easily. But David knew that he had to keep up the game. He said to him, look, Uriah, I was going to send you back today, but I've got a message for Joab, and it's not ready yet. So why don't you spend another day, another night here, and maybe it'll be ready tomorrow. And I appreciate your sentiments. I think they're noble, but look, if not for your sake, certainly for Bathsheba's sake, you ought to spend some time with her. But Uriah stayed in the city. He did not go home. The next day, I'm sure that David felt that he was moving towards being checkmated, and he thought he would try one more gamble. To Uriah, that message that I mentioned isn't quite ready yet. You'll have to stay over it till tomorrow. But, you know, I was thinking, if you don't want to see Bathsheba, that's certainly your business. But how about just coming to dinner with me tonight? We can chew a bone and drink a glass or two and make an evening of it. And I'd miss this chance to talk about what goes on in battle, and we can visit a while. David's strategy, of course, was obvious. He thought he would get Uriah bright and tight and then have him stagger out from the banquet table and flop in beside his pretty young wife for an evening of lovemaking before he went back to the battlefield again. But what David did not realize is that alcohol does not raise passions, it just lowers inhibitions. And Uriah's problem had nothing to do with inhibitions. So they ate and drank and talked and drank, and finally Uriah staggered out from the table of the king but went down with the servant. And the next day, when David saw Uriah coming out of his drunken stupor, he realized that his strategy hadn't worked. So David lost the game, but he would not lose the tournament. He set up the pieces again, and this time he would win with one sharp, quick move. He wrote to Joab, his general, and said, I want you to take Uriah, and I want you to put him at the forefront of the battle. And I want you to see that he's killed. Joab could be trusted. He did not explain why Uriah had to die. Joab didn't ask. He sent a note, and it was accomplished. A few days later, a messenger came back to see David, and he said to him, "Sir, we were pursuing the troops of the Ammonites, and we got up right up against the wall of the city, and their archers were able to take their bows and arrows, and they were able to shoot a number of our men, and among them Uriah the Hittite was killed." And Joab had said, "Be sure to put that in about Uriah." Because you see, it was a stupid thing for an army to get right up against the wall of the city. In fact, about 100 or so years before, there was a man by the name of Abinadab who had gotten so close to the wall of the city that a housewife had been able to take a stone, and drop it on his head and kill him. And the soldiers used to laugh about old Batty Abimelech. It was old bonehead play. It was funny. It was like the three badgers that ended up on third base. And to get that close to the wall was like explaining to the coach why you threw to second base instead of home, with the winning run coming home in the last of the ninth. No intelligent man would do it. But somehow David, this brilliant strategist, did not seem disturbed. I guess the messenger often wondered why he did not seem angry. Took it all philosophically and said, "Well, that's the way it is. You win some battles, you lose some men." He tells Joab to keep up the good work. And in a few days, after a proper period of mourning, David took Bathsheba to be his wife. After all, you have to remember a man, even if you've murdered him, but just as soon as he could, he made her queen. And everything was covered up. No one would ever know. David had danced the dance and did not have to pay the orchestra. Nobody would ever know. Oh, people might be suspicious. 9 months later, or 7 months later, that baby was born. People in the palace can count to nine just like anybody else, but they can never really be sure. Well, Joab would know, but not Joab could be trusted. But nobody else knew. Now, David, you're wrong. David, you're wrong. There is somebody else who knows. God knows. You may have ignored God, David, but God has not ignored you, David. David, God knows. And the historian says in the last verse of chapter 11, the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. And there was somebody else who knew. Nathan knew. Nathan was a prophet, and we're not quite sure how Nathan found out, but I suspect that he was a shrewd observer of life, and he knew about the visit of Uriah, and he knew about his unusual death, and he knew about that premature birth of the baby. He knew all of that. And he put it all together, and God sent Nathan to confront the king. Dangerous thing to rebuke a king. The dangerous thing is to rebuke a king when the king has a guilty conscience. The dangerous thing to rebuke a king with a guilty conscience when he's already killed one man in order to have his way. And so when Nathan came to preach before the king, he worked on his introduction. He began by telling him a story. He knew it would appeal to the heart of an old shepherd. He said, "Sir, in our kingdom there was a man who had great flock. He had herds. He was a wealthy man. And across the street from him, sir, there was a poor man who had just one little lamb. It was a pet of the family. It was almost like a daughter to him. He loved that little lamb very dearly, and that rich man had our visitors come, and instead of taking one of his flocks, when he wanted to prepare a barbecue dinner for the visitor, he went across the road and took that little lamb of his poor neighbor." As soon as he told the story, David knew that he had destroyed. He could see it in the flash of David's eyes. He could see his fist clenching. David said, "The man who did a thing like that ought to die. He'll restore fourfold all that he has taken." And in that moment, David had sat in judgment on David. David had a very tender conscience when it came to stealing land. Not nearly so tender when it came to stealing wives. And then there was a moment of quietness. And I think Nathan, probably with tears in his eyes and in a very quiet voice, said, "Your Majesty, you are the man." I could almost see David as he slumped back in his chair and stared at Nathan to see if perchance this is some kind of grim humor. But Nathan isn't smiling. And then Nathan goes on. He tells him everything. He spares him nothing. He says, "Your Majesty, I know it was a struggle, but it was God who gave you the victory over Saul. It was God who made you king. It was God who put you in the palace. And if you had but wanted it, Your Majesty, God would have given you anything you would have asked him for. But God saw you take your neighbor's wife. God saw you take your neighbor's wife. It was inexcusable. It was wrong." David sits back. His face has turned white. His legs shake. Nathan cannot even look at his skin. The two men sit quiet. Nathan, the prophet, has spoken the truth. Nathan, the friend, has said enough. And then David, in a voice that was quiet and strange, without any of the braggadocio of the king, without any of the confidence of the man in control, but without any cover-up, without any excuses, without any special pleading, says, "I have sinned against the Lord." And in those six words, he told the story. He had sinned with Bathsheba, he had sinned against Uriah, certainly, but ultimately David had sinned against God. The God that he had known and the God that he had ignored is not a God who had ignored him. David had sinned against God. What he thought at first was just an incidental thing. It was his downfall. And David knew what that meant. He had passed judgment on himself, and he had said that the man who did this must die. And David knew what that meant. It meant goodbye kingship, goodbye palace, goodbye reputation, and worst of all, it was goodbye relationship with God. How could he ever again get on his knees and ask God for anything? How could he again ever sing praises to God? How could he again ever sense the reality of God in his experience? It was goodbye God. There was no sacrifice in all of the Old Testament to cover this. David knew it, and he knew what it meant. Then after a time, Nathan the prophet reached over and touched David's arm. He said to David those words he wanted to hear more than any other in all the earth. "David, God has forgiven you. You will not die." I do not think that David was relieved primarily because he would not die. He was a brave man. I think he was relieved primarily because he realized that because of God's grace, he had now again been able to come back into a relationship with God. And it was that which mattered most to him. Nathan had one other thing to say. He said, "Your Majesty, because what you have done is blaspheme the name of God among the Gentiles, this child that was born will also die." And then he left. David sits alone in his throne, confronted by God. Not confronted by an orthodox doctrinal statement, but confronted by God. Not confronted by the words of a prophet, but confronted by a God who was really there. Early in his life, David had met God on the field of battle and met him in victory. Now in his middle years, he was confronted by God in defeat. But he met God, the God of judgment and the God of forgiving grace. Don't misunderstand. When David was forgiven, that did not wipe out the consequences. It really doesn't, you know. All sorts of things happened. So David went down to the far country and he took his children with him, and David came back home, but his children remained behind. You see his oldest son there, that boy Amnon? In a short time, he is going to be killed by his brother Absalom because Amnon raped Absalom's sister Tamar. And you see Absalom, that boy who is the darling of David's heart, he's going to be killed out on the field of battle by Joab, the very man who killed Goliath. And you see that three-year-old that David knew, his name is Adonijah. He's just a boy, but he grows up, and by the time he's 30, he rebels against his father and tries to take over the throne, and he is killed. And the Bible says never once in all of those years was David able to rebuke him. He couldn't rebuke him. He had lost his moral base. No. No, forgiveness does not wipe out consequences. It just doesn't. There were consequences to David's sin. Tennyson, in his Knights of the Round Table, talks of a young man by the name of Gareth who very much wanted to become a knight. And in order to become a knight, he had to fight two battles. He had to fight the battle of the morning star. And he had to fight the battle of the noontime sun. Two nights. Morning star, noontime sun. David fought those. If you live long enough, you'll fight them too. David fought the night of the morning star and won a great battle, seeing him before Goliath. It is a victory of faith over force. But when he fought the night of the noontime sun, he went down to crushing defeat. What we fail to realize is that it takes as much faith to be a king in the palace as it takes to be a soldier in the battlefield. It takes as much faith to live for God in your 47th year as in your 20th year. It takes as much faith to secure the victory as it does to obtain the victory. A few years ago, a man that I admired very deeply, a graduate of Dallas Seminary, fell into very deep moral sin. He had been the pastor of a large congregation. He was considered as the president of a theological seminary. I'd often said that he was one of the three most impressive men I'd ever served with in the ministry. And he fell. I had introduced his son to Jesus Christ, and I went and took that boy out to dinner. I remember sitting there in the restaurant and seeing what had happened to that youngster's life. Imagine to have your father leave in the morning, admired and respected, to come home at night. And everyone knew that he had been living for a year in hypocrisy and sin. I tried as best I could to somehow explain what had occurred. But he had been deeply wounded. Then I went to this man. He had been a friend, and I sat with him, and I said to him, "John, what do I tell the men at a theological seminary? What did I say to them?" Things like this occur. He said, "Tell them this. Tell them that whenever a man fails to walk with God, he walks on the edge of an abyss." And I told that to the men at Dallas Seminary, and I tell it to you. That no matter where you have climbed in the heights, when a man fails to walk aside, he lives on the edge of an abyss. John Knox took Scotland for God when he was well into his 50s. Someplace back there in his 40s, life had flattened out for him too. And in one of his journals, John Knox wrote something like this. He said, "I shall hold the ground that God has given me.